Okay, let's get started. We are on class number six. Just before we start, next week is going to be our final class because after that we are already in Yontif mode. And then we'll see after the Chagim, maybe I will come back. I haven't decided yet. But meanwhile, next week is going to be our final class. Okay, and as always, our tefillot and our learning for the safe and immediate return of the hostages, for the good health and shikum and rehabilitation of our soldiers and anyone else who's been wounded, and for our success in everything that we are doing here against our enemies. Okay, thank you, everybody. All right, let's start. Today, what we're going to do is we're going to finish up a couple of small things from last time about food. We didn't talk about bees. We didn't talk about the seven species, but that's really going to be very quick. And most of our class is going to be about structures, okay? Structures, as in houses, streets. Okay, what do we find in houses? Things like that. Okay, now on the one hand, that's probably the most ubiquitous and the easiest thing to see in archaeology. On the other hand, sometimes we misinterpret. We don't always know, what we're looking at. We try to figure that out. So we're going to try to do our best. With the caveats that what we'll be looking at is places in the land of Israel, okay, not in Babylonia. So even though some of the sources we're going to be looking at, a lot of the sources are going to be from the Talmud Bavli, we are going to be looking at places that are in Eretz Israel, so that it doesn't always match, and sometimes we assume it does when it shouldn't. Also, what we are going to be looking at today is mostly houses of ordinary people, right? People like you and me. I'm assuming most of you, right? We're not looking at the houses of ultra wealthy people. We could do that, but we want to get a sense of kind of everyday life as much as possible, okay? Everyone please mute themselves. And what we're looking at right here, and we're going to take advantage of this place a couple of times now. This is the layout of the Talmudic village in Katzrin. I don't know how many people have been there on your next trip to Israel. You should make your way up to the Golan and go there. The Golan, as we may have talked about in, I think, the first class or the second class, the Golan had many, many Jewish villages in Second Temple times, and particularly in the times of the Mishnah and the Gemara. It was a very common place for Jews to live after Jews no longer lived in Jerusalem, no longer lived in Judea. They move up north. We often talk about the towns of the Galil, right, of the Galilee, and the big cities of the Galilee, Tzipori, Tveria, Caesarea. But there are many, many small communities in the Golan, and because the Golan, it has been less developed than the Galil, we find a lot of these villages, and always that if they're Jewish villages, the outstanding building is the Beit Knesset, right? The Beit Knesset is the most of the synagogue is the most important building, often in the highest place, but not always. Here in Katzrin, you can see the synagogue over here on the side. We're not going to talk about synagogues today, but that is a very important part of a Jewish town. But what's great about Katzrin is, first of all, they found much of the town, so we get a sense of the layouts of the courtyards, things like that. We're also going to talk about Susia a little bit later. Susia also has a similar thing that we found so much of the town. But the other thing with Katzrin is that about 20 years ago, 25 years ago, the Katzrin Talmudic Village was created, okay, which is a village which tries to look at what did a typical house look like? What did a typical courtyard look like? Let's rebuild some of the furniture, and we're going to use that to understand what we're looking at. Okay. I'm just going to put the sources in the chat one more time for people who didn't get it. Okay. That's it. Yofi. Okay. So just to go back to two things from last time. Okay. Honey and bees. Okay. So when we talk about honey in Tanakh, Okay, we have two kinds of honey, well, probably even more than two kinds, but two main kinds, right? So if you look at our classic verse of the seven species, right? Eretz Chitah Oseh Orah, right? Oh, I didn't write where it's from. That was silly of me. Okay, but Devarim, okay? A land of wheat and barley, vines, figs, and pomegranates, a land of olive trees and honey. Okay, all of these sound very familiar except for honey, right? These are all agricultural products. These are all trees, bushes, whatever you want to call them, right? But where does the honey come in? So when we're talking about honey in this verse, we are not talking about bee honey, we're talking about date honey, okay? What we call silan, very common ingredient here in Israel. We use it for a lot of different things. So that's the honey that the seven species verse is talking about. We also hear about honey from bees, okay? Usually it's wild honey. I mean, in Tanakh, it's only wild honey. Okay, we have two stories and other verses that refer to honey, and it's talking about wild honey. Okay, probably the most famous story is the story of Shimshon, right? Samson, he's taken a shortcut to go meet his intended bride. A lion attacks him. He tears the lion in half and he leaves it there. A couple months later, he's walking on the same path and he sees there's a beehive that's been made inside the carcass of the lion, and he eats the honey, and then he uses this situation, this weird situation, as a riddle to the Philistine. So that's what you have here. Returning the following year to marry her, he turned aside to look at the remains of the lion, and in the lion's skeleton, he found a swarm of bees and honey. A wild honey. Bees show up and they make a hive. Another story that we have in the book of Samuel, right? Yonatan, Jonathan, Saul's son, is in the forest. He's in battle. He's exhausted. He hasn't eaten anything, and he sees some honey, and he takes some honey. And we have that great phrase. It says, "V'oru einav," his eyes lit up. Right? I always think of that when you have your kids and you don't give them sugar, and then they have that first taste of like sweet yogurt. "Oru einav," whoa, that. What have you been keeping from me all this time, right? But that's wild honey. And in fact, in Yeshayahu, right, in Isaiah, the very next verse you have here, we hear about this wild honey, and it kind of turns on its head. We like to talk about the land of milk and honey, right? And that's like, oh, everything's so wonderful. It's a land of milk and honey, right? There's just, you'll never go hungry. It's like, when they talk about the streets being paved with gold in America, right? But here, it's a little different. He shall obtain so much milk that he shall eat curds. Thus, everyone who is left in the land shall feed on curds and honey. Okay, milk and honey, basically. For in that day, every spot where there could stand 1,000 vines worth 1,000 shekels of silver shall become a wilderness of thorn brush and thistle. What's Yeshayahu talking about? He's talking about after the Assyrians come and conquer the land, right? There's going to be this massive destruction, and there's not going to be civilization. And when there's not civilization, who comes in? Who's able to, to thrive? Goats and bees, because things grow wild. The goats can go and eat all the thorns and the thistles. The bees can go and, use the flowers to make their honey, but it's not cultivated. Cultivated land doesn't leave so much space for the goats or even for the bees. I mean, we know bees we need for agriculture, but even so. Okay, so our question is, we have date honey in Tanakh, we have wild honey, but did they actually have like cultivated honey in Tanakh? Did people actually have beehives? So up until pretty recently, we didn't know the answer to that. We knew that in Egypt we have paintings, right? Tomb paintings of beehives, like of people who had beehives in their farms. But a couple of decades ago, there was an amazing excavation that was done in the Beit Sha'an Valley in a place called Tel Rehov, okay, where they discovered what you see in the picture on the top here, about 30 clay tubes, like pipes almost, okay, that are closed at one end. And inside, they found pieces of honeycomb and they found pieces of bees. Right? This is so cool. So this is actually a sign that somewhere in Tel Rehov there was a guy who raised bees for a living. This is what he did. And it shows us that really, even though Tanakh doesn't mention it, it was something that was definitely done. Now, by the time we get to Second Temple times, farmers are raising bees. That's a very common thing. You have your small farm, you have, your goats, your chickens, your doves. and your bees, because honey is a useful thing to have, and bees are also good for the agriculture. And that's where we get lots of halachot that have to do with the bees, right? So if you sell a beehive, have you sold the bees, right? If you sell a dove cote, have you sold the doves? This was just in the daf very recently. Can you give bees water on Shabbos, right? Are you allowed to do that? And the Mishnah says no, right? You can't place water before bees or before doves. Why? Because they're essentially independent, right? Bees can go out and get their own water. So by you feeding them on Shabbos, you're not allowed to do that. And we also have laws about where you could have your beehives, because beehives could be dangerous. And we have an opinion in the Tosafta. Rabbi Yossi says they distance the bees 50 amot from the city, which is a minority opinion, right? But it was an opinion. Rabbi Natan says the one who raises bees is like the one who raises dogs. Ooh, you know, not healthy, not friendly. We even have a great conversation in the Gemara in Bechorot that says, why is honey kosher, right? And think about it for a second. Why is honey kosher? It's a strange thing, honey. So the Gemara says, well, duh, it's kosher. They eat it in the Torah, right? But still, why is honey kosher? And they get into a very interesting conversation, which I don't know enough about bees or honey to say if it's true, but they say, well, the honey just passes through the body of the bee. It's not like milk that comes from a non-kosher animal. The honey really comes from the flower, not from the bees, and therefore it's kosher. Okay, interesting. I do not know more than that. Okay, our last food thing, the seven species. Okay, we know that the seven species, right, which we just saw before. Oh, here I wrote where it's from. Okay, are super important. In the Torah, they're not the only species that we have, but they definitely are very important. And we won't go into it. The people who came to my class that we did on nature last year, we talked about why they're so significant, and how they grow in the time between Pesach and Shavuot. You need perfect climate conditions. All right, we won't go into that. But Chazal are always trying to emphasize the importance of the land of Israel, and they're trying to emphasize the importance of the Beit HaMikdash, even when we don't have a Beit HaMikdash, even when we go into exile. Okay, so we mentioned in this class already, I think, you know, how measurements are always tied to the Beit HaMikdash, but we also want to tie things to the seven species. So we have this great statement in the Gemara in Sukkah. Our measures of halacha transmitted to Moshe from Sinai. They are written in the Torah. They're written in the Torah. Rav Hanin said this entire verse is stated for the purpose of teaching measures. What do we mean when we say measures? Right? So then the Gemara, I didn't bring the Gemara because it's very long. Okay, but the Gemara says, okay, well, chita, right? We have an idea of you have to eat something in a certain span of time. Kedei achilat pras. That's the amount of time it takes you to eat a piece of bread, right? Seorah, barley. We talk about impurity. Something has to be as big as a piece, a grain of barley. Okay, and we use that also for impurity for nida. Okay, we talk about gefen. We talk about grapes. You have to drink a revi'it of wine. Okay, a te'ana. You have to use a certain amount of dried fig is what counts when you are carrying on Shabbat. Right? Everything, and obviously kezayit, right? We always talk about a kezayit, like your kezayit of matzah that you eat on Pesach. Rimon, each one of them has its own significance in a measurement in halacha, which is great because it means we're always going to be going back. Even in, you know, in the exile, when we're not having those species readily available to us, we're always going to be thinking about them. Okay, Chazal love the seven species. One sign of affection is language. Almost every one of these species has its own name for harvesting it. Right, we have katsir for wheat and barley. Right, we have batsir for grapes. We have oreh for figs, and pomegranates, doesn't have its own. We have masik for olives, and we have gedid for dates. So it's great. You have your special words for each one. Okay. Needless to say, these fruits are very much part of the landscape. And so when we have decorations, like in synagogues, which is what I brought you here, one from Tzipori, one from Chamat Tveria, you have Pomegranates always, right? Pomegranates are the most beautiful fruit, but you also have grapes and you also have palm trees. You have a lot of this imagery all over the place. Okay, so much for food. We're going to go into houses. So this is again from the Talmudic village in Katsrin. They actually built this house so that you could actually walk in and see all the different parts of it. And I'm going to bring you some pictures from there. But let's understand what we're talking about when we talk about a typical house. It looks very big. That's only because it's cut open. It's really not very big and it's very kind of closed in. And we're going to see that one of the important elements in every house in Second Temple times, Mishnah times, even up until very recently, is a courtyard, right? Because your rooms are not particularly big. And perhaps even more important, you don't have clear glass, right? Clear glass has not been invented yet, or it's for very, very wealthy people. So you have to have some kind of window. You need some air, but it has to be open. So the windows are going to be very high up on the wall and they're going to be very small. You don't want people coming into your house. You don't want rain coming into your house. So you have very little light and fresh air. So you're going to spend as much time as you can outside in this courtyard. And we're going to talk about the courtyard. So what do you actually have in the house? So let's start from, we'll go in from the entrance, right? And go in. We have a little indoor kitchen. Okay, actually, this is the outdoor kitchen. I take that back. Okay, we have a little indoor kitchen, mostly for inclement weather. Okay, we have a storeroom where you keep your stuff. Okay, we have the main room, what we would call today the multi-purpose room. Okay, this is where you eat. This is where your kids sleep. This is where you hang out. This is where everything is happening. Okay. You have a ladder to what's called an aliyah or an aliyat gad, a second floor, a loft. We're going to talk about that in a moment. Okay. And don't forget, actually, really very important, you have the roof, okay, which is almost always flat. Okay. The roof is very useful. You use your roof for drying. You use your roof for things that you don't want people to bother you about, right? Like your courtyard, people are going in and out. But let's say I want to dry my figs. I don't want people stepping around and on it. So I lay out my figs on the roof. You use your roof when you want to have a little privacy. You go up there all by yourself. You use your roof in pre-air conditioning days to sleep outside, right? You'll sleep on the roof. It's safe. Nobody's going to bother you. It's a good place to be. Okay, so we have all these different pieces. Furniture, I didn't talk so much about furniture in this class. We talked a little about tables last time, and we talked about the money changer. What's our furniture? We have tables, we have chairs, we have benches, right? A safsal, that's a bench, is very important. We have a ladder. Okay, we have different kinds of ladders that the Mishnah talks about. We obviously have our cooking utensils that we'll get to. And what else? We have all kinds of storage things and cooking things, but also storage things, jugs, pots, etc. Okay, so let's, and here we have our courtyard, right? And our outdoor kitchen, our main outdoor kitchen. Okay, let's erase and move on. Oh, too much squiggling. All right, here we go. Yes, moving right along. Okay, Aliyat Gag, right? An attic. Now, very interesting. Why do you need an attic? Well, you want a little more space, but you also want privacy, right? You want privacy. Now, we have lots of discussions in the Mishnah, in the Gemara. Is the attic part of the house or not part of the house? Right? And we'll see why that's so important. But even if it's all one house, an attic gives you privacy, right? So we hear about an Aliyat Gag, we hear about an attic in Tanakh, right? If you remember the story with Elisha the prophet, and he would go and he would stop by this Isha HaShunamit, and he would stay by her. And after a while, she says, he comes all the time. Let's make him a small enclosed upper chamber, an Aliyat Gag, and put a bed, a table, right? It's a great puzzle because it tells you what were basic things that people needed. A bed, a table, a chair, and a lampstand so that he can come and stop there whenever he comes to us, right? This story is when he helps her to have a baby. baby and he has to bring the young child dies and he brings it back to life. Where does he take this boy to bring him back to life? To his Aliyat God, because it's not something that's for, public consumption. He does it privately. So it's a place that you could have a guest. It could be private. It could also be, and probably was for most people, right? If you think about these houses, right, and we know Arab houses up until like a generation or so ago, there's actually a study that was done here by archaeologists who went to these small, Arab villages in the southern Hebron Hills that were still living in this very, very traditional way, and they all lived in one room, basically. Now, Jews did that too, except the Jews are very, we're very, very careful about privacy for a husband and wife. So if you could manage to do it, you would have this Aliyat Gag. You would have this separate place for the parents to sleep by themselves. Okay. What else would you use this for? You'd use it again for a private place. It's not a lot of privacy in the ancient world. This is a private place. Okay. So we'll read some of those sources in a minute, but just to give you an idea why we need to know, is it part of the house? Is it not part of the house? Right. So for example, for issues of purity and impurity, there's a dead body in your house. Is the Aliyat Gag part of your house and therefore also impure, or is it not? Right? For vows, I make a vow. You really made me angry, and I vow that I am never going to set foot in your house. The Gemara says, well, okay, but can you go into the attic? Right? Which is a great question. And also for questions of damages, right? If something happens to the attic, who has to pay for it? So that's where we get to the Mishnah here in Bava Metzia. The house in the upper story belonging to two people that collapse, the two of them divide the timber and the stones and the earth. Who has to rebuild it, right? The top guy whose house collapsed on the bottom guy, the bottom guy, both of them. Do they own it together? Is one a renter? Right? We have a lot of permutations of this because the Gemara loves to have permutations of many things. Okay, so that makes sense. Okay, in terms of privacy, we have a few great stories, right? Probably one of the most famous Gemaras is this Gemara in Sanhedrin, which talks about the three sins that are yehareg ba'al yavor, right? For every sin that you in the world you can commit, if you're going to be killed if you don't do it, except for three, right? We all know murder, sexual relations, and avodah zarah and idol worship. But where do they determine this? The rabbis. So Rabbi Yochanan says in the name of Rabbi Shimon ben Yehotzadak, they counted the votes of those assembled, right? Nimnu v'gamru, and concluded in the upper story of the house of Nitza in the city of Lud. This is where they made this determination. Now, some people say that this determination was so important because it was a time of Shmad. It was a time of decrees against the Jews. Why are they meeting in the attic of this guy in the city of Lud? Because the Chachamim have to hide out, right? They can't be meeting in public. So that's one suggestion. We have a similar story, same place. Who is this Nitza? It would be great to discover his house. They're actually doing a lot of excavations in Lud now. Rabbi Tarfon and the elders were reclining in the loft of the house of Nitza in Lud when the question was asked, is study greater or is action greater? Right? It's a very important idea in Judaism. Should you be learning Torah? Should you be doing, right? And the answer, of course, is you have to do midrash mivili de maaseh, right? You have to study so that you can do. Right? So that's the idea that you have the space, that nobody's going to bother you, that you can be private. But you also have a situation where you would put people in the attic either because they're honored guests, or because you want to keep them safe, right? We have a story where there are captive women who were taken captive. They were freed. They have to be, rehabilitated. And meanwhile, they're put for the night in a rabbi's house in the attic, and he makes sure to take away the ladder so that he's not tempted to go up to where these women are, right? But then we have a different story, and here is the story on the bottom here. Once a man came to Rabbi Yoshua's house. He fed him and gave him the attic room to sleep in, removing the ladder afterwards, right? He put him in the attic. He gave him a lot of respect, but he took the ladder away. In the middle of the night, the guest took the dishes, put them in his cloak, and when he tried to go down, he fell from the attic and broke his neck. Right? And then the story goes on, and the guy comes. He says, "What's the matter with you? Why would you take away the ladder?" He says, "Well, why are you trying to sneak out in the middle of the night with my dishes?" Right? So this is what we call in Hebrew, kavdehu v'chashdehu. You should respect him, but you should also suspect him. Right? And that's a great Aliyat Gag story. Okay. We mentioned courtyards. Right, courtyards pretty much from the beginning of, people building habitations, people have come up with the idea of living in courtyards. It's a very smart way to make sure that you have light and you have air, but you also have privacy. The classic rooms of First Temple times, of biblical times, and we find these in places all over Israel, is what's called a four-room house. Okay, you see it here, and this is a one-family house. We're going to see shared courtyards in a minute, but this is a one-family house. Okay, and it's a four-room courtyard. What are the four rooms? You have one, you have two, you have three, and then you have this open space in the middle, okay, which provides you with a place to cook and to do your laundry and light and air. It's also, this is an archaeologist named Avi Faust who writes about this, who says it's very democratic, right? If you think about it, as opposed to, let's say, like a railroad flat where everybody has to go through the first rooms to get to the back room, here, no room is better than any other room. Every room can be re-accessed off of the courtyard. So it's a very democratic idea, which is a nice idea. We have these all over. We find them in this small version in Ir David, in Tel Sheva, in lots of places. We find them in kind of like a supersized version in Chatzor. One was discovered recently in the Old City in Jerusalem. So this is the classic design of biblical times. We get to Second Temple times. Okay, you might have a rich person who'll have a setup like that with their own courtyard. But most people have a shared courtyard, right? You have a house, a house, a house, a courtyard in the center of all of them. And that already leads you into all kinds of interesting and complicated questions about shared space. Okay, so for example, we have the issue of an Eruv Chatzerot, right? Not an Eruv of carrying, but carrying in like Rishut, in the public space, but carrying within your courtyard. So you say, okay, it's surrounded. What's the problem? No, because we have many people sharing this courtyard. We have to give the it has to look like we're all connected to each other, and that's why we all put in some food that we save, and it's as if we're having a meal together, right? And even today in communities, you have Erev Chatzerot. It's kept in the shul, right? But we have in the Mishnah, and Erevin goes into this question in exhaustive detail. Okay, and here we see that you have different types of shared courtyards. So, right, so look at the first source here. Brothers who were eating at their father's table and sleeping in their own houses in the same courtyard. Right, so here you get to this idea, which you see today in a lot of Arab communities. You have a chamula, right? You have a tribe. Each brother gets married, builds his own house off the courtyard. They're all related to each other. They're each separate, but they're all connected to each other. Okay, we can understand that. But then you have situations where you have all different kinds of strangers sharing a courtyard, and it could even be non-Jews, right? If you reside with a Gentile in the same courtyard, or if you live with someone who doesn't l believe in Erev, he's a kofer, he doesn't believe in this, what do we do about that, right? How do we negotiate that shared space? So much of Bava Batra is about how do we negotiate that shared space, right? And in fact, the very first Mishnah in Bava Batra says partners who wish to make a machitza, a partition in a jointly owned courtyard, build the wall for the partition in the middle of the courtyard, right? We might want to physically separate that space, right? We might want to divide it up. But a lot of times we might not want to divide it up because we don't have so much space, and we're just going to have to negotiate how to live together. So then we have all kinds of questions of what are you allowed to do in the courtyard that other people cannot object to, Right? So it just brought you one example here, and there are many. A man can protest against another that opens a shop within the courtyard and says to him, "I cannot sleep because of the noise of those that go in and out." Right? Can I open a bar in the courtyard? Can I? No. Can I open a grocery store that's going to be open at all hours, 24 hours? No, because people can't sleep. One who makes utensils should go outside and sell them in the market. But no one can protest and say to him, "I can't sleep because of the noise of the hammer or the noise of the millstones or the noise of the children." Sorry, that's the bargain of the courtyard. I'm going to do my work in the courtyard. There are going to be kids in the courtyard, right? There's even a question of can you be a teacher and have lessons in your courtyard, right? So it shows you that everybody knows your business. Everybody hears what's going on. Some things are allowed, some things are not. And we have this other very interesting statement. Rabbi Yochanan said in the name of Rabbi Bana, joint owners of a courtyard can stop one another from using the courtyard for any purpose, right? They can stop each other and realize all these things are. It's not halacha in the sense of Hilchot Shabbat. It's halacha in the sense of societal conventions, right? Everybody can come to an agreement together. It's not a black and white answer. One courtyard, they'll say, "Okay, you can have this small shop to sell your bread because I know not many people are coming in and out." Right? And others will say, no, I can't deal with even the noise of the hammer. They have to figure it out. But Rabbi Yochanan says something very interesting. You can stop other people from doing anything except washing clothes. You cannot force women to go outside of the courtyard to wash their clothes because it's immodest. It's not fitting that the daughters of Israel should expose themselves to the public gaze while washing clothes. So we have things that are inherently private, and we cannot make people go outside. They're allowed to use their private space or something like that that should be inherently private. Up until really very recently, courtyard shared courtyards were the way people lived. And by the way, in urban planning, they're coming back because it's a smart way to live. It saves a lot of space and allows people to actually meet their neighbors. Okay, what about cooking? Particularly the Gemara and Shabbos, but not only, we hear about a lot of different types of baking and cooking utensils. Okay? The main ones are, we have all three of them here in the Mishnah and Shabbat, a kira, a tanur, and a kupach. Okay, so let's just read the Mishnah. A kira that was lit on Shabbat Eve with straw or with raking scraps collected from the fields, one may place a pot of cooked food atop it. An oven, sorry, I want to read in the Hebrew and then we'll translate. A tanur that they lit even with straw may not place a pot either inside it or on top it on Shabbat. A kupach that was lit with straw rakings, its legal status is like that of a stove. Okay, so what are these three things? Okay. The tanur is the easiest to understand. Tanur was used throughout the ancient world, and even today, there are places that still use them. Okay, it's an oven. You can see it on the right here. This is a relatively recent picture, relatively recent, 70, 80 years ago. Okay, so you make it usually out of some kind of clay or mud. You make this structure that you put a fire inside, and then you can either put pots on top or you can put pot things inside the walls of the oven, right? Anyone who's come to Israel and has had a falafel in Jerusalem in particular, right? Jerusalem is the place that uses this term. Other places they say lafa, but in Jerusalem you say, "I want my falafel in an esh tanur," right? Esh tanur means it's that nice flat bread, but it's literally something that's made from the ish of the tanur. You put it on the walls, and you can still see very few, but they still exist, certainly in the old city. You can still see ovens like this. This is the tanur. You can put stuff on top, you can put stuff inside. The great advantage of the tanur is that once you put out the fire, it can stay hot for a long time. Okay? That's why you're not allowed to put anything in it or on it on Shabbat. However, you can put something in it or on it before Shabbat, and it will stay hot for a long time, right? So think of it as our plata or our hot plate, right? Something that's going to stay hot for a long time. A kira, okay? A kira is basically a fire that has stones on either side and a stone slab on top with holes where you can put pots. We have a beautiful example of it. It was found in Masada. All right, take a look down here. And it has two openings, and you can put pots on it, like, and really think of our stoves and our ovens. Just like your oven will take a while to cool down, right? But your stove, pretty much 2 minutes after you turn off the flame, it's going to get cool. Doesn't take a very long time. Same thing here. It cools off pretty quickly, and that's why you can put it on Shabbat. Okay, so that's a kira. A kupach is the same thing as a kira, but it's much smaller. It's usually only one pot. You can carry it from place to place. What's the fuel that you use in all of these things? So you use whatever you can find, right? And that's what we get a sense of from this Mishnah. It could be straw, it could be twigs, it could be dung, okay? It could be geffet. What's geffet? Talked about the olive press last time. After you've pressed and pressed and pressed and pressed, and there's no more oil left in your olives, you take all that gunk and you use that. That's called geffet. It's very, very, burns very, very well. Today, by the way, there are companies that work with olive oil makers, factories. They take all that gunk that otherwise would be thrown out and they press it and they make it into logs that you can use in your fireplace, which is a really cool thing to do. Okay, so that's our ovens and stoves. The other thing about ovens and stoves, we said you could have your indoor kitchen, but a lot of the times it's being done outdoors because of space constraints, because of smoke, because you just don't want this indoors. And when you're cooking outdoors, everybody knows what you're cooking. Okay, so in the pictures here, you have our tanur from Katrin, the reconstruction. But on the left here, this is a courtyard in Nachlaot in Jerusalem. This is the Batei Broida courtyard, and all courtyards in old cities had a central oven, right? First, you had places where you could do your cooking outdoors, but you also had a central oven where you put your chilling pots on Shabbos, right? That and everybody is there together, so everybody literally knows what's in your pots. It's not just an expression. And we have a great example of this in the Gemara in Tanit, right? Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa was very, very poor. And he was a miracle worker and he had no money. So we have this story. Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa's wife would heat the oven every Shabbat Eve, right? Every Friday, and create a great amount of smoke due to embarrassment to make it appear that she was baking despite the fact that there was no bread in her house. She didn't admit that she had nothing. She had a certain evil neighbor who said to herself, "Now I know they have nothing. What is all this smoke?" She went and knocked on the door to find out what was in the oven. Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa's wife was embarrassed. She ascended to an inner room, right, to the Aliyat Gog. But then a miracle happened. Her neighbor saw the oven filled with bread and the kneading basin filled with dough. And she said to Rabbi Chanina's wife, calling her by name, "So-and-so, bring a shovel. Your bread is burning," right? That's what happens when you are too nosy. Okay. Dishes. Pottery. Okay. We have other kinds of dishes, right? We have stone dishes. We talked about this a little last time. Stone dishes are a very great advantage, especially in Second Temple times, because they do not become impure, right? They don't become tameh. That's a big deal. However, they are much harder to make. They are much more expensive. Pottery is cheap, it's basic, it's easy. Everybody, even the poorest person, has pottery dishes, right? And it's the most basic kind of item. So you have a few times in the Gemara this phrase, right? Take a look here on Yevamot. If I hadn't lifted the earthenware shard, the chaspa, for you, would you have discovered the gem, the marganita beneath it? Right? It's one rabbi says to another. One guy says something so brilliant, and the other guy says, "Well, the only reason you knew that is because I said the thing that kind of laid the groundwork for your brilliant insight." Right? I lifted up that chaspa so you could find the pearl underneath. So it gives you a sense what's the most common item, right? Pottery. Pottery is something that's just, it's almost worthless, but it's not worthless because it's really very, very useful. And it's amazing for archaeologists because it's so ubiquitous and because every era has its own style, right? So if you find a piece of pottery that matches up with pottery that we can date because of an inscription, a coin, or whatever, we can date the layer that the other pottery came from. Also, pottery is useful even after it's broken. In biblical times, they use it to write on. It's called a straka, right? It's like your scrap paper. But in every time period, up until really pretty recently, you use broken pottery as fill, right? You put it in the foundation of your house. You put it in your wall to strengthen it. So that also is very useful because it helps us to date when things come from. Okay. Now, in the Torah, we hear a lot about kadim, right? Think about Rivka, who has the kad, right? She fills up the kad with the water. We hear about different kinds of dishes, but a kad is the most common term. In the Mishnah and the Gemara, we also hear about kad, but we also hear a lot about a different word called chavit. Right, a chavit today it means a barrel, but it meant a barrel for them too, but made out of pottery, not made out of wood. So basically, it's a term that's kind of a very vague term. It's used for large things, for storage, for oil, for wine, right, for water. It's not used for cooking, but you could have different sizes of it. So look at this story in Beitzah. Right, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus is teaching Torah on Yontif, and he's gone on for a while, and people are getting hungry. So the first group leaves. It says when the first group left, he said, "These must be the owners of the pitasim, of the very large jugs. They must have a lot to eat at home. They gotta leave now." The second group left, he said, "These are the owners of the chaviot, the barrels. Those are smaller. They don't have as much to eat, but they still have a lot." A third group left, and he said, "These are the owners of the kadim. Oh, they have even less food." And it goes on, and finally, there's just a few who are left, and they're so embarrassed. And he said, No, I'm not making fun of you. I'm making fun of them because they abandoned the eternal life of Torah and engaged in the temporary life." Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus believes that Yantif should be only for learning Torah. His contemporary, Rabbi Yehoshua, says, No, chetzio la'Hashem, chetzio lachem. Half is for Hashem. You should daven, you should learn, but half, you should go home and you should eat and you should enjoy your food. But it's a nice example for us of the different sizes of these kadim and chaviot. If we're very, very lucky, we find whole dishes like this beautiful one here. My friend, who's an archaeologist, sent me this picture. Usually, you have to put them back together. They're broken. If we're really, really lucky, we find ones that still have some residue of something inside, right? And then we can figure out what were the components of their wine, of their oil, and then we can like reverse engineer. We talked last time about wine and what did the wine taste like in the time of the Mishnah and the Gemara. That's when we're really, really lucky, and there are archaeologists who specialize in that kind of biology, and that's really interesting. Where do these dishes mostly come from? Much of the pottery in the land of Israel comes from the Upper Galilee. Okay, comes from two villages. One is called Kfar Hanania. One is called Shichin. Okay, Kfar Hanania is right over here. And actually, in modern Israel, the Tzomet, the intersection that is right next to it, is called Tzomet Kadarim, the Tzomet of the Potters, right? Pottery Junction, which is great. Okay? We've actually found pottery there, but we also know from our sources, right? Take a look in Shabbos. Vessels from Shichin and Kfar Hanania do not typically break, right? These are considered to be, whether because, probably both, because the craftsmen were good and also the raw materials, right? The dirt, the mud was good for making pottery. And then we have a different version of the same idea, but in the Midrashic form, right? Where, it's the equivalent of what we would call coals to Newcastle, right? Are you bringing straw to Ephraim, earthenware pots to Kfar Hanania, fleece to Damascus, sorcery to Egypt? Sorcery in a place of sorcerers, right? Why are you bringing this magic? Egypt is the place of magic. So what the example of coals to Newcastle is earthenware pots to Kfar Hanania. They have so much, they don't need yours, right? So that just gives us an idea of how this is a center for that. Okay, toilets. As I said to someone today, who doesn't love a good toilet, right? Toilets are great to find in archaeology. We have found them in First Temple times, almost always in houses that are clearly belonging to rich people. Okay, the picture on the right here is from Ir David. It's probably the most famous thing in Ir David. It's a toilet that was found there. You can see it's got a nice little seat and a hole in the right place. Not long ago, there was a toilet just like this that was found in excavations that were done near the promenade in Jerusalem in Talpiot, another house of wealthy people. We could tell from the other pieces of it. And hence, we have the great statement in the Gemara, Eizehu Ashir, you will all say Sameach b'chelko, someone who's happy with his lot. But there is a much more colorful answer besides the one that everybody knows. Sheyesh lo beit kisei samuch lebeito, he who has a toilet next to his table, which is just great, right? And next time someone says to you, are you rich? You say, yes, I am so rich because I have at least one toilet in my house. We also find in First Temple times a really interesting, unusual place for a toilet in excavations that were done just a couple years ago in the gates of the town of Lachish, right? Very important town in Judea. They discovered a small temple, an idolatrous temple with an altar, and inside the temple they found a toilet. Now, it was not a used toilet. What's the idea? We actually have a statement, a reference to this in the Book of Kings. If you wanted to desecrate a temple, and this is a temple for idolatry, or even if it's not for idolatry, it's not the Beit HaMikdash. If you want to desecrate it, put a toilet there. What's a more desecrating thing than to put a toilet there? We actually found an example of this, so that's just awesome. Okay. By Second Temple times, toilets are more common. The Romans, for sure, if you want to say one good thing about the Romans, they are really good at indoor plumbing, public toilets, toilets in people's houses. We even hear about a toilet in the Beit HaMikdash, not in the Beit HaMikdash, but in the area of Har HaBayit, right? In the Mishnah in Tamid, talks about the mikvaot, the subterranean mikvaot on Har HaBayit, and it also talks about a kisei kavod. To place a chair of honor. Okay, this was its honor. If you found the door closed, you would know there was a person there. Open, it was known there was no person there. Okay, no locks on bathrooms in the ancient world. The door was closed, you didn't go in. Okay, and now Chazal, like everything else that they talk about, there's an etiquette for going to the bathroom. Right? Chazal have rules for everything, and there are rules for going to the bathroom. Some of them are rules that we can totally identify with. Go often, don't hold it in, make sure you wash your hands after you go, right? Things that are perfectly normal things to say. Other things are less understandable to us. There's a feeling that bathrooms are places of demons and you better be careful there. You either have to be very quiet, as in the bottom source here from Brachot, right? There was a particular bathroom in the city of Tveria where two would enter even during the day. They would be harmed, presumably by demons. When Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi would each enter alone, they were not harmed. The sages said, aren't you afraid? They said, we have learned the tradition to avoid danger in the bathroom is to conduct oneself with modesty and silence. So there were all kinds of tricks that you would do if you went to the bathroom to keep the demons away. You'd go in pairs, you'd be very modest and quiet, or alternately, you would make noise. Okay. We hear about Rav Chisda's daughter who would make sure that her husband Rava was safe in the bathroom by shaking things and making noise. Okay. And if you go to the bathroom, don't forget to tell the angels to stay outside because angels don't need bathrooms, but angels are with you at all times, right? So we have this Gemara here. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't bring the source. I think it's also from Brachot. One who enters the bathroom says to the angels who accompany him at all times, be honored, honorable, holy ones, servants of the one on high, give honor to the God of Israel. Leave me till I enter and do my will and come back to you, right? Angels don't need the bathroom. People do. You guys stay outside. I'll go in. Okay. The Romans have bathrooms in public places as well as in private ones. This is a great public toilet in the city of Ostia in Rome. But we find public toilets in the land of Israel too, in Beit She'an. Actually, by the southern wall, right near the Temple Mount, after that becomes a Roman army camp. We actually find public toilets there for the soldiers who are there, which is a very sad juxtaposition. Right here we are by Har HaBayit with Roman army camp. They were very clever. They had a canal underneath that would flush away the water, right? Romans plumbing, they were excellent. Okay, keys and doors. Obviously, houses have doors. Houses also have keys. I did not go into all the complicated mechanism. If you would like to Google, keys in the time of Chazal, it was way too technical for me. But I'm sure there are many people here who can understand it. But we do know that there were keys. We hear about them in our sources, and we also see them in archaeology. So one of the really interesting things is that people who made very beautiful and elaborate, whether it was burial caves or ossuaries or sarcophagi, often they would add architectural elements, right? Because think about it, it is your house, it's your forever house, right? So what's great for us is that while we often do not have houses that are standing enough that we actually have a door left, right? Doors don't tend to stick around, they're usually made out of wood. We do have burial caves that are carved out of the mountain or have stone elements, and those do stick around, and it gives us an understanding of the architecture. So if you look at the picture on the top here, this is from Beit Sha'arim. This is the burial cave, one of the beautiful burial caves in Beit Sha'arim, and we have a beautiful doorway with a keyhole. All right, this is a place for your key right over here. We know that keys are used. We hear about them a lot. They're used in the Beit HaMikdash, right? In the Mishnah and Midot, we hear about the key ring and how the head of the Beit Av, of the group of Kohanim that would work that week, was in charge of the keys and in charge of locking up, right? There was a place, 1 cubit square, in which there was a slab of marble, and this was fixed a ring and a chain on which the keys were hung. When closing time came, the priest would raise the slab by the ring and take the keys from the chain, and he would lock up within while the Levite was sleeping outside. Right? We know in the Mikdash there are guards, there are shomrim. Right? God doesn't need guards, but it's kavod for the king that you have guards all the time, and so things are locked, and there are guards who are patrolling around. On a more prosaic level, in the endless list of things in Bava Batra, which I sold this, did it include that? I sold that, did it include this? We talk about doors and keys. Okay? If you sell a house, you haven't sold the key. Why? Because the principle always is you sell the fixed items and not the metaltalim, not the movable items. Presumably, you're going to give the guy the key, but it's not part of the sale. Okay? And again, right, the Mishnah in Bava Metzia, if you rent out a house, the landlord bears the responsibility for providing the door, providing the bolt, providing the lock. You have doors even in public spaces, right? At the ends of alleyways, what's called a mavoi she'eino mifulash, a closed alleyway. We're going to see it in another minute. For halachic purposes, but also for security purposes, right? I have my cul-de-sac and I want to close it off so nobody can come in. One of the most poignant keys that we have are these keys that you see here on the bottom. You can see the key mechanism. It's really very large and bulky. These keys were discovered in caves down in the Judean desert where refugees from the Bar Kokhba revolt ran away, brought all their whatever they could carry, right, their household items, their documents, all kinds of fascinating things with them, and they brought their keys because they thought they were going home, but they never went home, right? So that's something that is just, it's great for us in terms of like understanding what things look like, but it's also a very, very sad reminder of the outcome of this revolt. Okay, do we have time to do some streets? We'll do them quickly. Okay, we have many discussions, particularly in Masechet Eruvin, also in Shabbat, about different spaces, Rashuyot, Rishut HaYachid, Rishut HaRabim, public spaces, private spaces. Where can you carry? Where are you not allowed to carry? Is there such a thing as a Rishut HaRabim de'oraita from the Torah? Okay, so we know that a lot of cities and even towns have a main street. Here's the Cardo in Tsipori. We have the Cardo in Jerusalem. This is, well, that's, from later, but still interesting to know about. This is the main street in the town of Tveria. Okay. We have a main street that is open at both ends. Okay. The Mishnah talks about how a main street has to be open at both ends. A mavoi mifolash. Okay. But we also have this idea that the Rashi brings, it's actually not in the Gemara, that says that a Rishut HaRabim has to be of a certain width that we do have in the Gemara, 16 amot width, but that it has to be traversed by 600,000 people every day. Why 600,000? Kiminyan Yotzei Mitzrayim or Kiminyan the Machanot in the desert, right? Were there any streets in the ancient land of Israel that had 600,000 people on them per day? Definitely not. There are very few streets like that in the modern world. And so does it mean there is no such thing as a Rishut HaRabim d'Oraita? Probably not, because this is a source that we only find in Rashi. We don't find it in the Gemara. I'm not going to go into the halacha, but there are those who do say that and who therefore say you cannot actually have an eruv and you can't carry in major cities, but we will not be going into that. But in this discussion of what is a Rishut HaRabim, the Gemara and Shabbos, right? What is the public domain? What is the Rishut HaRabim? It mentions a few different things. A stratia and a platia, as well as an alleyway, a mavo, which is open on both ends, mavoi mifulash, connecting between main streets. That is a Rishut HaRabim. Now, what's interesting to us here are these terms, a stratia and a platia. This is not Hebrew, this is not Aramaic, this is Latin, Greek. Okay, Rashi explains what it is. He says a stratia is an intercity road, it's a highway connecting cities. A platia is a town square. These are words that come from the Latin. Platia comes from the Greek. Okay, stratia is a corruption of stratos, which is where our word street comes from. Okay, platia means a plaza, okay, or a forum is what the Romans would call it. Okay, do we have stratos? Yes, we do. Okay, this is a picture on the top here of what's called the Lithostrotos in the old city in Jerusalem. It's actually in the basement of a convent on the Via Dolorosa in the Muslim quarter. Okay, this is a street, a major street that's built by Hadrian at the time of the Bar Kokhba revolt. Christians believe that it's earlier, that it goes back to the time of Jesus, 130 years earlier, and this is where Jesus is tortured by the Roman soldiers. It's not, it's from the time of Hadrian, but it is the Lithostrotos. Okay. We also have forums built by Hadrian in Jerusalem, and sometimes what you'll have in a forum is scratched into the sidewalk, you'll have a game board because there are a lot of soldiers who are bored, who are sitting in the forum and guarding. They don't have cell phones, they don't have books. What are they doing? They're playing games, right? You take some pebbles, you scratch this into the floor, and you can play checkers, or you can play sheshbesh, or you can play whatever it is that you can play. Okay, so that is our street names, the Mavoi and the Lehi, and I think we'll save the last slide for the next time because I want to do some questions. But we have endless conversations in the Masechet Eruvin about how we can make places that we can carry in. Okay, if you have a mavoi she'eino mifulash, an alleyway that is closed on one end, and we have beautiful examples of this in the town of Susia in the southern Hebron Hills, where we can see main streets and we can see alleyways that are closed on one end, that are open on both ends. What do you have to do? You have to, according to Beit Shammai, add a korah and a lechi and a korah, a side post and a beam on top. Okay, and Beit Hillel says one or the other. Either way, what you have to do is you have to create something that looks like a doorway. Okay, Beit Hillel says only one. Now, if you go to Gamla in the Golan, Gamla was a Jewish town. Okay, in Second Temple times, you can actually see an alleyway that has a lechi. Okay, take a look. This is the normal wall of the alleyway, and this is an additional piece that was added in to create this lechi, which is going to make the Eruv. Okay, so it's a beautiful example of something that shows you here, this is a Jewish town. Okay, I want to talk about Beit Midrash, but I'm going to save it for next time. Let's take a look what we've got in the chat. Chat. Okay, hold on. Okay, is Rav Huna making a word play on the word for measurements? Oh, this is so far back in my PowerPoint that I don't even remember what we're talking about. Oh, midot, like the midot of the seven species. I don't think so. It means midot, like what you measure halachically. I don't think it's a wordplay at all. A roof for David to look over to the other roof with people there. Yes. Okay. We also use that. Roofs are not, might give you privacy, but not give other people privacy. Where does the water come from? So you have cisterns and you do have wells, right? You have both those kinds of things. You have what's called a be'er, which is a well. You dig to the groundwater, and you have a bor, which is a cistern where you collect rainwater. And also springs, right? A lot of towns were built near springs. How do you get to the attic without going through the house? Sometimes you would have, and they show you this in Katrin, you could have a separate entryway. Right, you could have a way to go around if it's built on multiple levels, or you could have a ladder outside, right? So there are ways to get in. You could have two separate entrances. Kohasu Chachamenu, yeah, for sure. Great stories. Okay, sorry, that was a private message. Oh, okay, yes, in Akko. Okay, the pot is round on the bottom and not flat. Exactly, right? Well, also, so you could put it down, not only so the heat doesn't escape, but also so you could put it down on the floor. How did drainage work before the Romans? Yeah, the Romans were really the best at doing this. But you just had, yeah, open on the side of the road. Okay, we haven't learned about fabric, sewing, education, writing, children's games. Oh my gosh, I don't know if I know about all those things, but those are very good points to make. Okay, thank you, everybody. Oh, Myrtle the girls in the ghost in the girls' bathroom. Yes. Could we forget Myrtle? Okay, any other comments, questions? All right. Thank you, everyone. Should be a Shabbat Shalom, Bisorot Tovot for all of us. And
Amen.
I will see you
Amen.
next week.
Sounds good.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.